CD 2.
Stang Fedlis, Monday, August 23rd, 3:02 a.m. Christ, it was cold, George Morton thought, climbing out of the Land Cruiser. The millionaire philanthropist stamped his feet and pulled on gloves, trying to warm himself. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and the sky glowed red, with streaks of yellow from the still visible sun. A bitter wind blew across the Sprengisandur, the rugged dark plain in the interior of Iceland. Flat gray clouds hung over the lava that stretched away for miles. The Icelanders loved this place. Morton couldn't see why. In any case, they had reached their destination. Directly ahead lay a huge, crumpled wall of dirt-covered snow and rock, stretching up to the mountains behind. This was Snorrijökull, one tongue of the huge Vatnajökull Glacier, the largest ice cap in Europe. The driver, a graduate student, climbed out and clapped his hands with delight.
Not bad at all. Quite warm. You are lucky. It's a pleasant August night.
He was wearing a t-shirt, hiking shorts, and a light vest. Morton was wearing a down vest, a quilted windbreaker, and heavy pants. And he was still cold. He looked back as the others got out of the back seat. Nicholas Drake, thin and frowning, wearing a shirt and tie and a tweed sport coat beneath his windbreaker, winced as the cold air hit him. With his thinning hair, wire-framed glasses, and pinched, disapproving manner, Drake conveyed a scholarly quality that, in fact, he cultivated. He did not want to be taken for what he was. A highly successful litigator who had retired to become the director of the National Environmental Resource Fund, a major American activist group. He had held the job at NERF for the last 10 years. Next, young Peter Evans bounced out of the car. Evans was the youngest of Morton's attorneys, and the one he liked best. Evans was 28 and a junior associate of the Los Angeles firm of Hassel & Black. Now, even late at night, he remained cheerful and enthusiastic. He pulled on a Patagonia fleece and stuck his hands in his pockets, but otherwise gave no sign that the weather bothered him. Morton had flown all of them in from Los Angeles on his Gulfstream G5 jet, arriving at Keflavik Airport at 9 yesterday morning. None of them had slept, but nobody was tired, not even Morton, and he was 65 years old. He didn't feel the slightest sense of fatigue, just cold. Morton zipped up his jacket and followed the graduate student down the rocky hill from the car.
The light at night gives you energy, the kid said. Dr. Enerson never sleeps more than 4 hours a night in the summer. None of us does.
And where is Dr. Enerson? Morton asked.
Down there,
the kid pointed off to the left.
At first, Morton could see nothing at all. Finally, he saw a red dot and realized it was a vehicle.
That was when he grasped the enormous size of the glacier. Drake fell into step with Morton as they went down the hill.
George, he said, you and Evans should feel free to go on a tour of the site and let me talk to Peter Enerson alone.
Why?
I expect Enerson would be more comfortable if there weren't a lot of people standing around.
But isn't the point that I'm the one who funds his research?
Of course, Drake said. But I don't want to hammer that fact too hard. I don't want Pierre to feel compromised.
I don't see how you can avoid it.
I'll just point out the stakes, Drake said. Help him to see the big picture.
Frankly, I was looking forward to hearing this discussion,
Morton said. I know, Drake said, but it's delicate.
As they came closer to the glacier, Morton felt a distinct chill in the wind. The temperature dropped several degrees. They could see now the series of 4 large tan tents arranged near the red Land Cruiser. From a distance, the tents had blended into the plain. From one of the tents, a very tall blonde man appeared. P. Pierre Enerson threw up his hands and shouted, "Nicholas! Pierre!" Drake raced forward. Morton continued down the hill, feeling distinctly grouchy about being dismissed by Drake. Evans came up to walk alongside him.
"I don't want to take any damn tour," Morton said.
"Oh, I don't know," Evans said, looking ahead. "It might be more interesting than we think." Coming out of one of the other tents were three young women in khakis, all blonde and beautiful. They waved to the newcomers.
"Maybe you're right," Morton said.
Peter Evans knew that his client George Morton, despite his intense interest in all things environmental, had an even more intense interest in pretty women. And indeed, after a quick introduction to Enerson, Morton happily allowed himself to be led away by Eva Jonsdottir, who was tall and athletic, with short-cropped white blonde hair and a radiant smile. She was Morton's type, Evans thought. She looked rather like Morton's beautiful assistant, Sarah Jones. He heard Morton say,
"I had no idea so many women were interested in geology."
And Morton and Eva drifted away, heading toward the glacier. Evans knew he should accompany Morton, but perhaps Morton wanted to take this tour alone. And more important, Evans's firm also represented Nicholas Drake. And Evans had a nagging concern about what Drake was up to. Not that it was illegal or unethical, exactly, but Drake could be imperious, and what he was going to do might cause embarrassment later on. So for a moment, Evans stood there, wondering which way to go, which man to follow. It was Drake who made the decision for him, giving Evans a slight dismissive wave of his hand as he disappeared into the big tent with Enerson. Evans took the hint and ambled off toward Morton and the girl. Eva was chattering on about how 12% of Iceland was covered in glaciers and how some of the glaciers had active volcanoes poking out from the ice. This particular glacier, she said, pointing upward, was of the type called a surge glacier, because it had a history of rapid advances and retreats. At the moment, she said, the glacier was pushing forward at the rate of 100 meters a day, the length of a football field every 24 hours. Sometimes, when the wind died, you could actually hear it grinding forward. This glacier had surged more than 10 kilometers in the last few years. Soon they were joined by Asdis Svensdottir, who could have been Eva's younger sister. She paid flattering attention to Evans, asking him how his trip over had been, how he liked Iceland, how long he was staying in the country. Eventually, she mentioned that she usually worked in the office at Reykjavik and had only come out for the day. Evans realized then that she was here doing her job. The sponsors were visiting Enerson, and Enerson had arranged for the visit to be memorable. Eva was explaining that although surge-type glaciers were very common, there were several hundred of them in Alaska, the mechanism of the surges was not known, nor was the mechanism behind the periodic advances and retreats, which differed for each glacier.
"There is still so much to study, to learn," she said, smiling at Morton.
That was when they had heard shouts coming from the big tent and considerable swearing. Evans excused himself and headed back to the tent. Somewhat reluctantly, Morton trailed after him. Pierre Enerson was shaking with anger. He raised his fists.
"I tell you no!"
he yelled and pounded the table. Standing opposite him, Drake was very red in the face, clenching his teeth.
"Pierre," he said, "I am asking you to consider the realities. You are not!"
Enerson said, pounding the table again.
"The reality is what you do not want me to publish."
"Now, Pierre,
the reality," he said, "that in Iceland the first half of the 20th century was warmer than the second half, as in Greenland. The reality is that in Iceland most glaciers lost mass after 1930 because summers warmed by 0.6 degrees Celsius. But since then, the climate has become colder. The reality is that since 1970, these glaciers have been steadily advancing. They have now regained half the ground that was lost earlier. Right now, 11 are surging. That is the reality, Nicholas, and I will not lie about it.
No one has suggested you do, Drake said, lowering his voice and glancing at his newly arrived audience. I am merely discussing how you word your paper, Pierre.
Enerson raised a sheet of paper. Yes? And you have suggested some wording.
Merely a suggestion.
That twists truth.
Pierre, with due respect, I feel you are exaggerating.
Am I?
Enerson turned to the others and began to read.
This is what he wants me to say. The threat of global warming has melted glaciers throughout the world, and in Iceland as well. Many glaciers are shrinking dramatically, although paradoxically others are growing. However, in all cases, recent extremes in climate variability seem to be the cause, blah, 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 args for famwegus.
He threw the paper down.
That is simply not true.
It's just the opening paragraph. The rest of your paper will amplify.
The opening paragraph is not true.
Of course it is. It refers to extremes in climate variability. No one can object to such vague wording.
Recent extremes, but in Iceland these effects are not recent.
Then take out recent.
That is not adequate,
Einar said.
Because the implication of this paragraph is that we are observing the effects of global warming from greenhouse gases, whereas in fact we are observing local climate patterns that are rather specific to Iceland and are unlikely to be related to any global pattern.
And you can say so in your conclusion.
But this opening paragraph will be a big joke among Arctic researchers. You think Motoyama or Sergesen will not see through this paragraph? Or Hicks, Watanabe, Isaacson? They will laugh and call me compromised. They will say I did it for grants.
But there are other considerations, Drake said soothingly. We must all be aware there are disinformation groups funded by industry, petroleum, automotive, who will seize on the report that some glaciers are growing and use it to argue against global warming. That is what they always do. They snatch at anything to paint a false picture.
How the information is used is not my concern. My concern is to report the truth as best I can.
Very noble, Drake said. Perhaps not so practical.
I see. And you have brought the source of funding right here, in the form of Mr. Morton. So I do not miss the point?
No, no, Pierre, Drake said hastily. Please, don't misunderstand.
I understand only too well. What is he doing here?
Enochson was furious.
Mr. Morton, do you approve of what I am being asked to do by Mr. Drake?
It was at that point that Morton's cell phone rang, and with ill-conceived relief, he flipped it open.
Morton?
Yes.
Yes, John. Where are you, Vancouver? What time is it there?
He put his hand over the mouthpiece.
John Kim in Vancouver, Scotiabank.
Evans nodded, though he had no idea who that was. Morton's financial operations were complex. He knew bankers all over the world. Morton turned and walked to the far side of the tent. An awkward silence fell over the others as they waited. Enerson stared at the floor, sucking in his breath, still furious. The blonde women pretended to work, giving great attention to the papers they shuffled through. Drake stuck his hands in his pockets, looked at the roof of the tent. Meanwhile, Morton was laughing.
Really? I hadn't heard that one, he said, chuckling.
He glanced back at the others and turned away. Drake said,
Look, Pierre, I feel we have gotten off on the wrong foot.
Not at all, Enerson said coldly. We understand each other only too well. If you withdraw your support, you withdraw your support.
Nobody is talking about withdrawing support.
Time will tell, he said.
And then Morton said, What?
They did what? Deposited to what? How much money are...
Jesus Christ, John. This is unbelievable.
And still talking, he turned and walked out of the tent. Evans hurried after him. It was brighter. the sun now higher in the sky, trying to break through low clouds. Morton was scrambling up the slope, still talking on the phone. He was shouting, but his words were lost in the wind as Evans followed him. They came to the Land Cruiser. Morton ducked down, using it as a shield against the wind.
"Christ, John, do I have legal liability there? I mean, no, I didn't know a thing about it. What was the organization? Friends of the Planet Fund?"
Morton looked questioningly at Evans. Evans shook his head. He'd never heard of Friends of the Planet, and he knew most of the environmental organizations.
"Based where?" Morton was saying. "San Jose? California?" "Oh, Jesus. What the hell is based in Costa Rica?"
He kept his hand over the phone.
"Friends of the Planet Fund. San Jose, Costa Rica."
Evans shook his head.
"I never heard of them," Morton said, "and neither has my lawyer. And I don't remember. No, Ed, if it was $250,000, I'd remember. The check was issued where?"
"I see.
And my name was where?"
"I see. Okay, thanks. Yeah, I will. Bye."
He flipped the phone shut. He turned to Evans.
"Peter," he said, "get a pad and make notes."
Morton spoke quickly. Evans scribbled, trying to keep up. It was a complicated story that he took down as best he could. John Kim, the manager of Scotiabank, Vancouver, had been called by a customer named Nat Damon, a local marine operator. Damon had deposited a check from a company called Seismic Services in Calgary, and the check had bounced. It was for $250,000. Damon was nervous about whoever had written the check and asked Kim to look into it. John Kim could not legally make inquiries in the U.S., but the issuing bank was Calgary, and he had a friend who worked there. He learned that Seismic Services was an account with a postal box for an address. The account was modestly active, receiving deposits every few weeks, from only one source: the Friend of the Planet Foundation, based in San Jose, Costa Rica. Kim placed a call down there. Then, about that time, it came up on his screen that the check had cleared. Kim called Damon and asked him if he wanted to drop the inquiry. Damon said no, check it out. Kim had a brief conversation with Miguel Chavez at the Banco Credito Agricola in San Jose. Chavez said he had gotten an electronic deposit from the Mariah Wind Power Associates via Ansbach Cayman Limited, a private bank on Grand Cayman Island. That was all he knew. Chavez called Kim back 10 minutes later to say he had made inquiries at Ansbach and had obtained a record of a wire transfer that was paid into the Mariah account by the International Wilderness Preservation Society 3 days before that. And the IWPS transfer noted in the comment field, G. Morton Research Fund. John Kim called his Vancouver client, Nat Damon, to ask what the check was for. Damon said it was for the lease of a small two-man research submarine. Kim thought that was pretty interesting. So he telephoned his friend, George Morton, to kid him a bit and ask why he was leasing a submarine. And to his surprise, Morton knew absolutely nothing about it. Evans finished taking down notes on the pad. He said, "This is what some bank manager in Vancouver told you?"
"Yes, a good friend of mine. Why are you looking at me that way?"
"Because it's a lot of information," Evans said. He didn't know the banking rules in Canada, to say nothing of Costa Rica, but he knew it was unlikely that any banks would freely exchange information in the way Morton had described. If the Vancouver manager's story was true, there was more to it than he was telling. Evans made a note to check into it. "And do you know the International Wilderness Preservation Society, which has your check for $250,000? Morton shook his head.
"Never heard of them."
"So you never gave them $250,000? Morton shook his head.
"I'll tell you what I did do in the last week,"
he said. I gave 250 grand to Nicholas Drake to cover a monthly operating shortfall. He told me he had some problem about a big contributor from Seattle not coming through for a week. Drake's asked me to help him out before like that once or twice.
You think that money ended up in Vancouver?
Morton nodded.
You better ask Drake about it, Evans said.
I have no idea at all, Drake said, looking mystified. Costa Rica? International Wilderness Preservation? My goodness, I can't imagine.
Evans said, you know the International Wilderness Preservation Society?
Very well, Drake said. They're excellent. We've worked closely with them on any number of projects around the world. The Everglades, Tiger Tops in Nepal, the Lake Toba Preserve in Sumatra. The only thing I can think is that somehow George's check was mistakenly deposited in the wrong account. Or, I just don't know. I have to call the office. But it's late in California. It'll have to wait until morning.
Morton was staring at Drake, not speaking.
George, Drake said, turning to him, I'm sure this must make you feel very strange, even if it's an honest mistake, as I am almost certain it is. It's still a lot of money to be mishandled. I feel terrible. But mistakes happen, especially if you use a lot of unpaid volunteers as we do. But you and I have been friends for a long time. I want you to know that I will get to the bottom of this. And of course, I will see that the money is recovered at once. You have my word, George.
Thank you, Morton said.
They all climbed into the Land Cruiser. The vehicle bounced over the barren plain.
Damn, those Icelanders are stubborn, Drake said, staring out the window. They may be the most stubborn researchers in the world.
He never saw your point?
Evans said. No, Drake said. I couldn't make him understand. Scientists can't adopt that lofty attitude anymore. They can't say, I do the research and I don't care how it is used. That is out of date. It's irresponsible. Even in a seemingly obscure field like glacier geology, because like it or not, we're in the middle of a war, a global war of information versus disinformation. The war is fought on many battlegrounds. Newspaper op-eds, television reports, scientific journals, websites, conferences, classrooms, and courtrooms too, if it comes to that.
Drake shook his head.
We have truth on our side, but we're outnumbered and outfunded. Today the environmental movement is David battling Goliath. And Goliath is Aventis, and Acadel, Humana, and GE, BP, Bayer, Shell, and Glaxo Welcome. Huge global corporate. These people are the implacable enemies of our planet. And Pierre Enerson, out there on his glacier, is irresponsible to pretend it isn't happening.
Sitting beside Drake, Peter Evans nodded sympathetically, though in fact he took everything Drake was saying with a large grain of salt. The head of NERF was famously melodramatic, and Drake was pointedly ignoring the fact that several of the corporations he had named made substantial contributions to NERF every year, and three executives from those companies actually sat on Drake's board of advisors. That was true of many environmental organizations these days, although the reasons behind corporate involvement were much debated.
Well, Morton said, maybe Pierre will reconsider later on.
I doubt it, Drake said gloomily. He was angry. We've lost this battle, I'm sorry to say. But we do what we always do. Soldier on. Fight the good fight.
It was silent in the car for a while.
The girls were damn good looking, Morton said. Weren't they, Peter?
Yes, Evans said. They were.
Evans knew that Morton was trying to lighten the mood in the car, but Drake would have none of it. The head of NERF stared morosely at the barren landscape and shook his head mournfully at the snow-covered mountains in the distance. Evans had traveled many times with Drake and Morton in the last couple of years.
Usually Morton could cheer everybody around him, even Drake, who was glum and fretful.
But lately Drake had become even more pessimistic than usual. Evans had first noticed it a few weeks ago and had wondered at that time if there was illness in the family or something else that was bothering him. But it seemed there was nothing amiss. At least, nothing that anyone would talk about. Nerf was a beehive of activity. They had moved into a wonderful new building in Beverly Hills. Fundraising was at an all-time high. They were planning spectacular new events and conferences, including the abrupt climate change conference that would begin in 2 months. Yet despite these successes, or because of them, Drake seemed more miserable than ever. Morton noticed it too, but he shrugged it off.
"He's a lawyer," he said. "What do you expect? Forget about it."
By the time they reached Reykjavik, the sunny day had turned wet and chilly. It was sleeting at Keflavik Airport, obliging them to wait while the wings of the white Gulfstream jet were de-iced. Evan slipped away to a corner of the hangar, and, since it was still the middle of the night in the U.S., placed a call to a friend in banking in Hong Kong. He asked about the Vancouver story.
"Absolutely impossible," was the immediate answer. "No bank would divulge such information, even to another bank."
"There's an STR in the chain somewhere."
"An STR?
Suspicious transfer report. If it looks like money for drug trafficking or terrorism, the account gets tagged. And from then on, it's tracked. There are ways to track electronic transfers, even with strong encryption. But none of that tracking is ever going to wind up on the desk of a bank manager.
No,
not a chance. You need international law enforcement credentials to see that tracking report."
"So this bank manager didn't do all this himself?
I doubt it. There is somebody else involved in this story. A policeman of some kind. Somebody you're not being told about.
Like a customs guy or Interpol or something."
"Why would my client be contacted at all?"
"I don't know. But it's not an accident."
"Does your client have any radical tendencies?"
Thinking of Morton, Evans wanted to laugh.
"Absolutely not."
"You're quite sure, Peter?"
"Well, yes. Because sometimes these wealthy donors amuse themselves or justify themselves by supporting terrorist groups. That's what happened with the IRA. Rich Americans in Boston supported them for decades. But times have changed. No one is amused any longer. Your client should be careful. And if you're his attorney, you should be careful, too.
Hate to visit you in prison, Peter."
And he hung up. 2 Los Angeles, Monday, August 23rd, 1:04 p.m. The flight attendant poured Morton's vodka into a cut glass tumbler.
"No more ice, sweetie," Morton said, raising his hand.
They were flying west over Greenland, a vast expanse of ice and cloud and pale sun beneath them. Morton sat with Drake, who talked about how the Greenland ice cap was melting and the rate at which the Arctic ice was melting. And Canadian glaciers were receding. Morton sipped his vodka and nodded.
"So Iceland is an anomaly?"
"Oh, yes," Drake said. "An anomaly. Everywhere else, glaciers are melting at an unprecedented rate."
"It's good we have you, Nick," Morton said,
putting his hand on Drake's shoulder. Drake smiled. "And it's good we have you, George," he said. "We wouldn't be able to accomplish anything without your generous support. You've made the Vanuatu lawsuit possible, and that's extremely important for the publicity it will generate. And as for your other grants, well, words fail me."
"Words never fail you," Morton said, slapping him on the back.
Sitting across from them, Evans thought they really were the odd couple. Morton, big and hearty, dressed casually in jeans and a work shirt, always seeming to burst from his clothes. And Nicholas Drake, tall and painfully thin, wearing a coat and tie, with his scrawny neck rising from the collar of a shirt that never seemed to fit. In their manner, too, they were complete opposites. Morton loved to be around as many people as possible, loved to eat and laugh. He had a penchant for pretty girls, vintage sports cars, Asian art, and practical jokes. His parties drew most of Hollywood to his Holmby Hills mansion. His charity functions were always special, always written up the next day. Of course, Drake attended those functions, but invariably left early, sometimes before dinner, often pleaded illness, his own or a friend's. In fact, Drake was a solitary ascetic man who detested parties and noise. Even when he stood at a podium giving a speech, he conveyed an air of isolation, as if he were alone in the room. And being Drake, he made it work for him. He managed to suggest that he was a lone messenger in the wilderness, delivering the truth the audience needed to hear. Despite their differences in temperament, the two men had built a durable friendship that lasted the better part of a decade. Morton, the heir to a forklift fortune, had the congenital uneasiness of inherited wealth. Drake had a good use for that money, and in return provided Morton with a passion and a cause that informed and guided Morton's life. Morton's name appeared on the board of advisors of the Audubon Society, the Wilderness Society, the World Wildlife Fund, and the Sierra Club. He was a major contributor to Greenpeace and the Environmental Action League. All this culminated in two enormous gifts by Morton to NERF. The first was a grant of $1 million to finance the Venutu lawsuit. The second was a grant of $9 million to NERF itself to finance future research and litigation on behalf of the environment. Not surprisingly, the NERF board had voted Morton their concerned citizen of the year. A banquet in his honor was scheduled for later that fall in San Francisco. Evans sat across from the two men, idly thumbing through a magazine. But he had been shaken by the Hong Kong call and found himself observing Morton with some care. Morton still had his hand on Drake's shoulder and was telling him a joke, as usual, trying to get Drake to laugh. But it seemed to Evans that he detected a certain distance on Morton's part. Morton had withdrawn, but didn't want Drake to notice. This suspicion was confirmed when Morton stood up abruptly and headed for the cockpit. "I want to know about this damn electronic thing," he said. Since takeoff, they had been experiencing the effects of a major solar flare that rendered satellite telephones erratic or unusable. The pilot said the effect was heightened near the poles and would soon diminish as they headed south. And Morton seemed eager to make some calls. Evans wondered to whom. It was now 4 a.m. in New York, 1 a.m. in Los Angeles. Who was Morton calling? But of course it could concern any of his ongoing environmental projects. Water purification in Cambodia, reforestation in Guinea, habitat preservation in Madagascar, medicinal plants in Peru. To say nothing of the German expedition to measure the thickness of the ice in Antarctica. Morton was personally involved in all these projects. He knew them in detail, knew the scientists involved, had visited the locations himself. So it could be anything. But somehow Evans felt it wasn't just anything. Morton came back. "Pilots say it's okay now." He sat by himself in the front of the plane, reached for his headset, and pulled the sliding door shut for privacy. Evans turned back to his magazine. Drake said, "You think he's drinking more than usual?" "Not really," Evans said. "I worry." "I wouldn't," Evans said. "You realize," Drake said, "we are just 5 weeks from the banquet in his honor in San Francisco. That's our biggest fundraising event of the year. It will generate considerable publicity, and it'll help us launch the conference on abrupt climate change." "Uh-huh," Evans said. "I'd like to ensure that the publicity focuses on environmental issues and not anything else. Of a personal nature, if you know what I mean." Evans said,
Isn't this a conversation you should be having with George? Oh, I have. I only mention it to you because you spend so much time with him.
I don't really.
You know he likes you, Peter, Drake said. You're the son he never had, or... hell, I don't know, but he does like you. And I'm just asking you to help us if you can.
I don't think he'll embarrass you, Nick.
Just keep an eye on him.
Okay, sure.
At the front of the plane, the sliding door opened. Morton said, Mr. Evans, if you please.
Peter got up and went forward. He slid the door shut behind him.
I've been on the phone to Sarah, Morton said.
Sarah Jones was his assistant in L.A. Isn't it late?
It's her job. She's well paid. Sit down.
Evans sat in the chair opposite. Have you ever heard of the NSIA?
No.
The National Security Intelligence Agency?
Evans shook his head.
No. But there are 20 security agencies.
Ever heard of John Kenner?
No.
Apparently, he's a professor at MIT.
No,
Evans said. Sorry. Does he have something to do with the environment?
He may. See what you can find out.
Evans turned to the laptop by his seat and flipped open the screen. It was connected to the internet by satellite. He started to type.
In a few moments, he was looking at a picture of a fit-looking man with prematurely gray hair and heavy horn-rimmed glasses. The attached biography was brief. Evans read it aloud. Richard John Kenner, William T. Harding, Professor of Geo-Environmental Engineering.
Whatever that means, Morton said.
He is 39, doctorate in civil engineering from Caltech at age 20. Did his thesis on soil erosion in Nepal. Barely missed qualifying for the Olympic ski team. A J.D. from Harvard Law School. Spent the next 4 years in government. Department of the Interior Office of Policy Analysis. Scientific advisor to the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee. Hobby is mountain climbing. He was reported dead on Nyakanga Peak in Nepal, but he wasn't. Tried to climb K2, driven back by weather.
K2? Morton said. Isn't that the most dangerous peak?
I think so.
Looks like he's a serious climber. Anyway, he went to MIT, where I'd say his rise has been spectacular. Associate professor in 93, director of the MIT Center for Risk Analysis in 95, William T. Harding professor in 96, consultant to the EPA, the Department of the Interior, the Department of Defense, the government of Nepal. God knows who else. Looks like a lot of corporations, and since 2002 on faculty leave.
Meaning what?
Just says he's on leave.
For the last 2 years?
Morton came and looked over Evans's shoulder.
I don't like it. The guy burns up the track at MIT, goes on leave, and never comes back. You think he's got into trouble?
I don't know, but Evans was calculating the dates. Professor Kenner got a doctorate from Caltech at 20, got his law degree from Harvard in 2 years instead of three. Professor at MIT when he's 28.
Okay, so he's smart, Morton said. I still want to know why he's on leave and why he's in Vancouver.
Evans said, he's in Vancouver?
He's been calling Sarah from Vancouver.
Why?
He wants to meet with me.
Well, Evans said, I guess you'd better meet with him.
I will, Morton said.
But what do you think he wants?
I have no idea. Funding? A project? Sarah says he wants the meeting to be confidential. He doesn't want anybody to be told.
Well, that's not hard. You're on an airplane.
No, Morton said, jerking his thumb. He specifically doesn't want Drake to be told.
Maybe I'd better attend this meeting, Evans said.
Yes, Morton said. Maybe you should.
Los Angeles, Monday, August 23rd, 4:09 p.m. The iron gate swung open, and the car drove up the shaded driveway to the house that slowly came into view. This was Holmby Hills, the wealthiest area of Beverly Hills. The billionaires lived here, in residences hidden from the street by high gates and dense foliage. In this part of town, security cameras were all painted green and tucked back unobtrusively. The house came into view. It was a Mediterranean-style villa, cream-colored, and large enough for a family of 10. Evans, who had been speaking to his office, flipped his cell phone shut and got out as the car came to a stop. Birds chirped in the ficus trees. The air smelled of the gardenia and jasmine that bordered the driveway. A hummingbird hung near the purple bougainvillea at the garage. It was, Evans thought, a typical California moment. Evans had been raised in Connecticut and schooled in Boston. Even after 5 years in California, the place still seemed exotic to him. He saw that another car was parked in front of the house, a dark gray sedan. It had government license plates. From out of the front door came Morton's assistant, Sarah Jones, a tall blonde woman of 30, as glamorous as any movie star. Sarah was dressed in a white tennis skirt and pink top, her hair pulled back in a ponytail. Morton kissed her lightly on the cheek. "You playing today?"
"I was. My boss came back early."
She shook Evans's hand and turned back to Morton.
"Good trip?"
"Fine. Drake is morose, and he won't drink. It gets tiresome."
As Morton started toward the door, Sarah said,
"I think I ought to tell you. They're here right now."
"Who is?"
"Professor Kenner. And another guy with him. Foreign guy."
"Really? But didn't you tell them they had to..."
"Make an appointment? Yes, I did. They seem to think that doesn't apply to them. They just sat down and said they'd wait."
"You should have called me."
"They got here 5 minutes ago."
"Huh? Okay." He turned to Evans. "Let's go, Peter."
They went inside. Morton's living room looked out on the garden in back of the house. The room was decorated with Asian antiques, including a large stone head from Cambodia. Sitting erectly on the couch were two men. One was an American of middle height, with short gray hair and glasses. The other was very dark, compact, and very handsome, despite the thin scar that ran down the left side of his face in front of his ear. They were dressed in cotton slacks and lightweight sport coats. Both men sat on the edge of the couch, very alert, as if they might spring up at any moment.
"Look military, don't they?"
Morton muttered as they went into the room.
The two men stood. "Mr. Morton, I'm John Kenner from MIT, and this is my colleague, Sanyong Thapa, a graduate student from Mustang in Nepal."
Morton said, "And this is my colleague, Peter Evans."
They shook hands all around. Kenner's grip was firm. Sanyong Thapa gave a very slight bow as he shook hands. He spoke softly, with a British accent.
"How do you do?"
"I didn't expect you," Morton said, "so soon."
"We work quickly."
"So I see. What's this about?"
"I'm afraid we need your help, Mr. Morton."
Kenner smiled pleasantly at Evans and Sarah.
"And unfortunately, our discussion is confidential."
"Mr. Evans is my attorney," Morton said, "and I have no secrets from my assistant."
"I'm sure," Kenner said. "You may take them into your confidence whenever you choose, but we must speak to you alone."
Evans said, "If you don't mind, I'd like to see some identification."
"Of course,"
Kenner said. Both men reached for wallets. Evans was shown Massachusetts driver's licenses, MIT faculty cards, and passports. Then they handed out business cards. There were telephone numbers, fax, email. Evans turned the cards over. It all looked straightforward. Kenner said,
"Now, if you and Miss Jones will excuse us."
They were outside in the hallway, looking into the living room through the large glass doors. Morton was sitting on one couch, Kenner and Sanyong were on the other. The discussion was quiet. In fact, it looked to Evans just like one more of the endless investment meetings that Morton endured. Evans picked up the hall phone and dialed a number.
Center for Risk Analysis, a woman said. Professor Kenner's office, please. One moment. Clicking, another voice.
Center for Risk Analysis, Professor Kenner's office.
Good afternoon, Evans said. My name is Peter Evans, and I'm calling for Professor Kenner. I'm sorry, he is not in the office.
Do you know where he is?
Professor Kenner is on extended leave.
It's important that I reach him, Evans said. Do you know how I could do that?
Well, it shouldn't be hard, since you are in Los Angeles, and so is he.
So she had seen the caller ID, Evans thought. He would have imagined Morton had a blocked ID, but evidently not. Or perhaps the secretary in Massachusetts had a way to unblock it.
Well, Evans said, can you tell me?
I'm sorry, Mr. Evans, she said, but I am not able to help you further. Click.
Sarah said, what was that about? Before Evans could answer, a cell phone rang in the living room. He saw Kenner reach into his pocket and answer briefly. Then he turned, looked at Evans, and waved. Sarah said, his office called him?
Looks like it.
So I guess that's Professor Kenner.
I guess it is, Evans said, and we're dismissed.
Come on, Sarah said. I'll give you a ride home.
They walked past the open garage, the row of Ferraris glinting in the sun. Morton owned 9 vintage Ferraris, which he kept in various garages. These included a 1947 Spider Corsa, a 1956 Testa Rosa, and a 1959 California Spider, each worth more than $1 million. Evans knew this because he reviewed the insurance every time Morton bought another one. At the far end of the line was Sarah's black Porsche convertible. She backed it out, and he climbed in beside her. Even by Los Angeles standards, Sarah Jones was an extremely beautiful woman. She was tall, with a honey-colored tan, shoulder-length blonde hair, blue eyes, perfect features, very white teeth. She was athletic in the casual way that California people were athletic, generally showing up for work in a jogging suit or short tennis skirt. She played golf and tennis, scuba dived, mountain biked, skied, snowboarded, and God knew what else. Evans felt tired whenever he thought about it. But he also knew that she had issues, to use the California word. Sarah was the youngest child of a wealthy San Francisco family. Her father was a powerful attorney who had held political office. Her mother was a former high fashion model. Sarah's older brothers and sisters were all happily married, all successful, and all waiting for her to follow in their footsteps. She found her family's collective success a burden. Evans had always wondered why she chose to work for Morton, another powerful and wealthy man, or why she had come to Los Angeles at all, since her family regarded any address south of the Bay Bridge to be hopelessly tawdry. But she was good at her job and devoted to Morton. And, as George often said, her presence was aesthetically pleasing. And the actors and celebrities who attended Morton's parties agreed. She had dated several of them, which further displeased her family. Sometimes Evans wondered if everything she did was rebellion, like her driving. She drove quickly, almost recklessly, shooting down Benedict Canyon, heading into Beverly Hills. Do you want to go to the office or your apartment?
My apartment, he said. I have to pick up my car.
She nodded, swerved around a slow-moving Mercedes, then cut left down a side street. Evans took a deep breath.
Listen, she said, do you know what net war is?
What?
He wasn't sure he had heard her over the sound of the wind.
Net war.
No, he said, why?
I heard them talking about it before you showed up, Kenner and that Sanyong guy.
Evans shook his head.
Doesn't ring a bell. You sure it wasn't netware?
Might have been.
She swept across Sunset, running a yellow light, and then downshifted as she came to Beverly.
You still on Roxbury?
He said he was. He looked at her long legs, protruding from the short white skirt.
Who were you going to play tennis with?
I don't think you know him.
It's not a...
No, that's over.
I see.
I'm serious, it's over.
Okay, Sarah, I hear you.
You lawyers are all so suspicious.
So, it's a lawyer you're playing with.
No, it is not a lawyer. I don't play with lawyers.
What do you do with them?
As little as possible, like everybody else.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Except you, of course, she said, giving him a dazzling smile.
She accelerated hard, making the engine scream. Peter Evans lived in one of the older apartment buildings on Roxbury Drive in the flats of Beverly Hills. There were 4 units in his building across the street from Roxbury Park. It was a nice park, a big green expanse, always busy. He saw Hispanic nannies chatting in groups while they minded the children of rich people, and several oldsters sitting in the sun. Off in a corner, a working mother in a business suit had taken off lunch to be with the kids. The car screeched to a stop.
Here you are.
Thanks, he said, getting out.
Isn't it time to move? You've been here 5 years.
I'm too busy to move, he said.
Got your keys?
Yeah. But there's always one under the doormat. He reached in his pocket, jingled metal.
All set. See ya.
And she raced off, squealed around the corner, and was gone. Evans walked through the little sunlit courtyard and went up to his apartment on the 2nd floor. As always, he had found Sarah slightly distressing. She was so beautiful and so flirtatious. He always had the feeling that she kept men at a distance by keeping them off balance. At least she kept him off balance. He could never tell if she wanted him to ask her out or not. But considering his relationship with Morton, it was a bad idea. He would never do it. As soon as he walked in the door, the phone began to ring. It was his assistant, Heather. She was going home early because she felt sick. Heather frequently felt sick toward the afternoon, in time to beat rush hour traffic. She tended to call in sick on Fridays or Mondays, yet the firm showed a surprising reluctance to fire her. She had been there for years. Some said she had had a relationship with Bruce Black, the founding partner, and that ever since Bruce lived in constant dread that his wife would find out, since she had all the money. Others claimed Heather was seeing another of the firm's partners, always unspecified. A third story was that she had been on the scene when the firm moved offices from one Century City skyscraper to another, in the course of which she stumbled on some incriminating documents and copied them. Evans suspected the truth was more mundane, that she was a clever woman who had worked in the firm long enough to know everything about wrongful termination suits and now carefully gauged her repeated infractions against the cost and aggravation of their firing her. And in this way, worked about 30 weeks a year. Heather was invariably assigned to the best junior associate in the firm, on the assumption that a really good attorney wouldn't be hampered by her inconstancy. Evans had tried for years to get rid of her. He was promised a new assistant next year. He saw it as a promotion. "I'm sorry you don't feel well," he told Heather dutifully. One had to go along with her pretense.
"It's just my stomach," she said. "I have to see the doctor."
"Are you going today?"
"Well, I'm trying to get an appointment."
"All right, then.
But I wanted to tell you that they set a big meeting for the day after tomorrow, 9 o'clock in the big conference room."
"Oh?"
"Mr. Morton just called. Apparently 10 or 12 people are called."
"You know who?"
"No. They didn't say."
Evans thought useless.
"Okay," he said. "And don't forget you have the arraignment for Morton's daughter next week. This time it's Pasadena, not downtown. And Margot Lane's calling about her Mercedes lawsuit. And that BMW dealer still wants to go forward."
"He still wants to sue the church?"
"He calls every other day." "Okay. Is that it?" "No, there's about 10 others. I'll try to leave the list on your desk if I feel well enough."
That meant she wouldn't.
"Okay," he said. "Are you coming in?"
"No, it's too late. I need to get some sleep."
Then I'll see you tomorrow.
He realized he was very hungry. There was nothing to eat in the refrigerator except a container of yogurt of indeterminate age, some wilted celery, and a half-finished bottle of wine left over from his last date about 2 weeks earlier. He'd been seeing a girl named Carol, who did product liability at another firm. They'd picked each other up in the gym and had begun a desultory intermittent affair. They were both busy and not especially interested in each other, to tell the truth. They met once or twice a week, had passionate sex, and then one of them would plead a breakfast appointment the next day and go home early. Sometimes they went to dinner as well, but not usually. Neither of them wanted to take the time. He went into the living room to check his answering machine. There was no message from Carol. But there was a message from Janice, another girl he sometimes saw. Janice was a trainer in the gym, the possessor of one of those L.A. bodies, perfectly proportioned and rock hard. Sex for Janice was an athletic event involving multiple rooms, couches, and chairs, and it often left Evans feeling vaguely inadequate, as if his body fat weren't low enough for her. But he continued to see her, feeling vaguely proud that he could have a girl who looked so astonishing, even if the sex wasn't that good. And she was often available on short notice. Janice had a boyfriend who was older, a producer for a cable news station. He was out of town a lot, and she was restless. Janice had left a message the night before. Evans didn't bother to call her back. With Janice, it was always that night or forget it. Before Janice and Carol, there had been other women, more or less the same. Evans told himself he should find a more satisfying relationship, something more serious, more adult, more suited to his age and station in life. But he was busy and just took things as they came. Meanwhile, he was hungry. He went back down to his car and drove to the nearest drive-in, a hamburger joint on Pico. They knew him there. He had a double cheeseburger and a strawberry shake. He went home, intending to go to bed. Then he remembered he had owed Morton a call. "I'm glad you called," Morton said. "I've just been going over some things with... going over some things." "Where are we now on my donations to NERF? The Venutu lawsuit, all that?"
"I don't know," Evan said. "The papers are drawn and signed, but I don't think anything's been paid yet."
"Good. I want you to hold off payments."
"Sure. No problem."
"Just for a while."
"Okay."
"There's no need to say anything to NERF."
"No, no, of course not."
"Good." Evans hung up.
He went into the bedroom to get undressed. The phone rang again. It was Janice, the exercise instructor.
"Hey," she said. "I was thinking about you, and I wondered what you were doing."
"As a matter of fact, I was going to bed."
"Oh? Pretty early for that."
"I just got in from Iceland."
"So you must be tired."
"Well," he said, "not that tired."
"Want company?"
"Sure." She giggled and hung up.
Beverly Hills, Tuesday, August 24th, 6:04 a.m. Evans awoke to the sound of rhythmic gasping. He flung his hand across the bed, but Janice wasn't there. Her side of the bed was still warm. He raised his head slightly, yawning. In the warm morning light, he saw one slender, perfectly formed leg rise above the foot of the bed to be joined by the other leg. Then both legs slowly descended, gasping. Then legs up again.
"Janice," he said, "what are you doing?"
"I have to warm up."
She stood, smiling, naked, and at ease, confident of her appearance, every muscle outlined.
"I have a class at 7.
"What time is it?"
6.
He groaned and buried his head in the pillow.
"You really should get up now," she said. "It shortens your lifespan to sleep in."
He groaned again.
Janice was full of health information. It was her job.
"How can it possibly shorten my life to sleep?"
They did studies on rats. They didn't let them sleep. And you know what? They lived longer.
Uh-huh. Would you mind turning on the coffee?
Okay, she said. But you really should give up coffee.
She drifted out of the room.
He swung his feet onto the floor and said, Haven't you heard? Coffee prevents strokes.
It does not, she said from the kitchen. Coffee has 923 different chemicals in it, and it is not good for you.
New study, he said.
It was true, too.
Besides, it causes cancer.
That's never been shown.
And miscarriages.
Not a concern for me.
And nervous tension.
Janice, please.
She came back, crossing her arms across her perfect breasts as she leaned against the door jamb. He could see the veins in her lower abdomen, running down to her groin.
Well, you are nervous, Peter. You have to admit it.
Only when I look at your body.
She pouted. You don't take me seriously.
She turned back into the kitchen, showing him her perfect high glutes.
He heard her open the refrigerator.
There's no milk.
Black is fine.
He stood and headed for the shower.
Did you have any damage? She said.
From what?
From the earthquake. We had a little one while you were gone, about 4.3.
Not that I know.
Well, it sure moved your TV.
He stopped in mid-stride.
What? It moved your TV. Look for yourself.
The morning sunlight that slanted through the window clearly showed the faint outline where the base of the television had compressed the carpet. The TV had been moved about 3 inches from its former position. It was an old 32-inch monitor, and damned heavy. It didn't move easily. Looking at it now gave Evans a chill.
You're lucky, she said. You have all those glass things on your mantle. They break all the time, even in a small quake. Do you have an insurance policy?
He didn't answer. He was bent over, looking behind the television at the connections. Everything looked normal. But he hadn't looked behind his TV for about a year. He really wouldn't know.
By the way, she said, this is not organic coffee. You should at least drink organic. Are you listening to me?
Just a minute. He had crouched down in front of the television, looking for anything unusual beneath the set. He could see nothing out of the ordinary.
And what is this? She said.
He looked over. She was holding a donut in her hand.
Peter, Janice said severely, do you know how much fat's in these things? You might as well just eat a stick of butter.
I know. I should give them up.
Well, you should, unless you want to develop diabetes later in life. Why are you on the floor?
I was checking the TV.
Why? Is it broken?
I don't think so. He got to his feet.
The water is running in your shower, she said. That's not environmentally conscious.
She poured coffee, handed it to him.
Go and take a shower. I've got to get to my class.
When he came out of the shower, she was gone. He pulled the covers up over the bed, as close as he ever came to making it, and went into the closet to dress for the day. Century City, Tuesday, August 24th, 8:45 a.m. The law firm of Hassel & Black occupied 5 floors of an office building in Century City. They were a forward-looking, socially aware firm. They represented many Hollywood celebrities and wealthy activists who were committed to environmental concerns. The fact that they also represented 3 of the biggest land developers in Orange County was less often publicized. But, as the partners said, it kept the firm balanced. Evans had joined the firm because of its many environmentally active clients, particularly George Morton. He was one of 4 attorneys who worked almost full-time for Morton, and for Morton's pet charity, the National Environmental Resource Fund, NERF. Nevertheless, he was still a junior associate, and his office was small, with a window that looked directly at the flat glass wall of the skyscraper across the street. Evans looked over the papers on his desk. It was the usual stuff that came to junior attorneys.
There was a residential sublet, an employment agreement, written interrogatories for a bankruptcy, a form for the Franchise Tax Board, and two drafted letters threatening lawsuits on behalf of his clients. One for an artist against a gallery refusing to return his unsold paintings, and one for George Morton's mistress, who claimed that the parking attendant at Sushi Roku had scratched her Mercedes convertible while parking it. The mistress, Margaret Lane, was an ex-actress with a bad temper and a propensity for litigation. Whenever George neglected her, which in recent months was increasingly often, she would find a reason to sue somebody, and the suit would inevitably land on Evans's desk. He made a note to call Margot. He didn't think she should proceed with this suit, but she would take convincing. The next item was a spreadsheet from a Beverly Hills BMW dealer who claimed that What Would Jesus Drive campaign had hurt his business because it denigrated luxury cars. Apparently, his dealership was a block from a church, and some parishioners had come around after services and harangued his sales staff. The dealer didn't like that, but it looked to Evans as if his sales figures were higher this year than last. Evans made a note to call him, too. Then he checked his emails, sorting through 20 offers to enlarge his penis, 10 offers for tranquilizers, and another 10 to get a new mortgage now before rates started to rise. There were only a half dozen emails of importance, the first from Herb Lowenstein, asking to see him. Lowenstein was the senior partner on Morton's account. He did mostly estate management, but handled other aspects of investments as well. For Morton, estate management was a full-time job. Evans wandered down the hall to Herb's office. Lisa, Herb Lowenstein's assistant, was listening on the phone. She hung up and looked guilty when Evans entered.
"He's talking to Jack Nicholson."
"How is Jack?"
"He's good. Finishing a picture with Merrill. There were some problems."
Lisa Ray was a bright-eyed 27-year-old and a dedicated gossip. Evans had long ago come to rely on her for office information of all sorts. "What's Herb want me for?"
"Something about Nick Drake."
"What's this meeting about tomorrow at 9?
"I don't know," she said, sounding amazed. "I can't find out a thing."
"Who called it?"
"Morton's accountants."
She looked at the phone on her desk.
"Oh, he's hung up. You can go right in."
Herb Lowenstein stood and shook Evans's hand perfunctorily. He was a pleasant-faced, balding man, mild-mannered and slightly nerdy. His office was decorated with dozens of pictures of his family stacked 3 and 4 deep on his desk. He got on well with Evans, if only because these days, whenever Morton's 30-year-old daughter got arrested for cocaine possession, it was Evans who went downtown at midnight to post her bail. Lowenstein had done it for many years, and now was glad to sleep through the night.
"So," he said, "how was Iceland?"
"Good. Cold."
"Is everything okay?"
"Sure.
I mean, between George and Nick, everything okay there?"
"I think so. Why?"
"Nick is worried. He called me twice in the last hour."
"What about?"
"Where are we on George's NERF donation?"
"Nick's asking that?"
"Is there a problem about it?"
"George wants to hold off for a while."
"Why?"
"He didn't say."
"Is it this Kenner guy?"
"George didn't say. He just said, hold off."
Evans wondered how Lowenstein knew about Kenner.
"What do I tell Nick?"
"Tell him it's in the works, and we don't have a date for him yet."
"But there's not a problem with it, is there?"
"Not that I've been told," Evans said.
"Okay,"
Lowenstein said.
"In this room, tell me, is there a problem?"
"There might be." Evans was thinking that George rarely held up charitable donations. And there had been a certain tension in the brief talk he had had with him the night before.
"What's this meeting about tomorrow morning?"
Lowenstein said.
"The big conference room."
"Beats me."
"George didn't tell you?"
"No."
"Nick is very upset."
"Well, that's not unusual for Nick."
"Nick has heard of this Kenner guy." He thinks he's a troublemaker. Some kind of anti-environmental guy.
I doubt that. He's a professor at MIT in some environmental science.
Nick thinks he's a troublemaker.
I couldn't say.
He overheard you and Morton talking about Kenner on the airplane.
Nick should stop listening at keyholes.
He's worried about his standing with George.
Not surprising, Evans said. Nick screwed up on a big check, got deposited in the wrong account.
I heard about that. It was an error by a volunteer. You can't blame Nick for that.
It doesn't build confidence.
It was deposited to the International Wilderness Preservation Society, a great organization. And the money is being transferred back even as we speak.
That's fine.
Where are you in this?
Nowhere.
I just do what the client says. But you advise him.
If he asks me. He hasn't asked.
Sounds like you've lost confidence yourself.
Evans shook his head.
Herb, he said, I'm not aware of any problem.
I'm aware of a delay. That's all.
Okay,
Lowenstein said, reaching for the phone.
I'll calm Nick down.
Evans went back to his office. His phone was ringing. He answered it.
What are you doing today? Morton said. Not much.
Paperwork. That can wait. I want you to go over and see how that Vanuatu lawsuit is coming.
Geez, George, it's still pretty preliminary. I think the filing is several months away.
Pay them a visit, Morton said.
Okay. They're in Culver City. I'll call over there.
No, don't call. Just go.
But they're not expecting.
That's right. That's what I want. Let me know what you find out, Peter.
And he hung up.
End of CD 2.